ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's nice to be with you. It's Tuesday, the 3rd of March. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, Iran shockwaves, how a faraway war could affect you and the Australian economy. And release the frogs, 12,000 endangered frogs, hop back into the wild.
To be able to be here after 6 months of breeding this batch up, getting them fed and nice, fat, juicy frogs ready for release now, it's really special.
US President Donald Trump has used his first White House appearance since ordering large-scale attacks on Iran to try and justify his decision to start the war. The president says this was the last best chance to stop Iran's regime and has vowed to pursue the war for as long as necessary. Meanwhile, Defence Minister Richard Marles has confirmed that Australia's Middle East military headquarters in the UAE was hit by Iranian drones over the weekend without injury or casualty. Oliver Gordon here.
Now or never.
This was our last best chance to strike.
This is the rationale US President Donald Trump has used to justify starting a war with Iran.
An Iranian regime armed with long-range missiles and nuclear weapons would be an intolerable threat to the Middle East, but also to the American people.
President Trump, who had campaigned strongly on ending US involvement in overseas wars, acknowledged the U.S. soldiers killed so far.
In their memory, we continue this mission with ferocious, unyielding resolve to crush the threat.
And indicated the U.S. could extend its deployment in the region.
Right from the beginning, we projected 4 to 5 weeks, but we have capability to go far longer than that.
The U.S. and Israel struck Iran on Saturday, killing Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. They continue to carry out large-scale combat operations, aided by supersonic B-1 bombers. This Tehran police station, now a pile of rubble and twisted metal, is one of more than 1,000 targets the US says it's hit so far.
Why are they doing this? Why are they destroying our nation like this, both before and now? Do they know how these lives can possibly be rebuilt?
This Iranian woman, one of many in the country's capital, coming to terms with the damage.
I swear, we struggled for 47 years to build our lives.
Just days into the fighting, the conflict has already spread across the Middle East. Israel launched multiple strikes on what it said were Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. Lebanese health authorities say the strikes have killed at least 52 people and led to large-scale evacuations in Beirut. The IDF also says it's targeted the complex of Iran's state broadcaster in Tehran. UN Israel envoy Danny Danon.
We will not stop until we achieve our objectives.
There's been a lack of clarity as to whether or not America's aim is to disarm Iran of nuclear weapons or effect regime change. Marco Rubio is the Secretary of State and America's top diplomat.
And two things can be true. Number one is our mission and our focus is the destruction of their ballistic missile capabilities and their ability to manufacture them, as well as the threat posed by their Navy to global shipping. That's the objective. That said, we would not mind, we would not be heartbroken, and we hope that the Iranian people can overthrow this government and establish a new future for that country. We'd love for that to be possible. But the objective of this mission is the destruction of their ballistic missile capabilities and of their naval capabilities.
Overnight, three U.S. jets were shot down in Kuwait in an apparent friendly fire incident. No casualties were recorded, and all six crew members aboard ejected safely before being recovered. Footage has emerged of the moment Kuwaiti locals found one of the pilots.
You need something to help you? No problem, you're safe.
Fallout from the war has reached Australia. Reports some mosques are holding events to mourn the death of Iran's supreme leader have angered many in the Iranian diaspora. Rana Dadpour is a spokesperson for advocacy group Oz-Iran.
These memorials should be stopped as soon as possible. You know, the Iranian-Australian community are very worried and concerned and traumatized, actually, about these memorials that are happening. This is to our community.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has discouraged Australians from mourning the death of Ayatollah Khamenei and doesn't think such events are appropriate. Shadow Defence Minister James Patterson wants authorities to investigate.
The IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, of which the Ayatollah is the spiritual leader and head, is now a listed terrorist organisation in Australia. And it is a crime to praise or glorify a listed terrorist organisation in a way that could incite others to commit acts of terrorism. It's also a crime to display the symbols and logos of a listed terrorist organisation. So I think the Federal Police should be investigating as to whether those events are in violation of the law.
Shadow Defence Minister James Patterson there, Oliver Gordon reporting. While Donald Trump says US strikes could continue for 4 or 5 weeks, despite the enormous might of the US military, their supply of weapons such as anti-ballistic missiles is not as unlimited as you'd think. And that depletion is being watched closely by Russia, with eyes on Ukraine, and China, with an eye on Taiwan. Dr. Malcolm Davis is a senior analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Malcolm, the US and Israel have conducted more than 2,000 strikes on Iran during Operation Epic Fury, with at least 10 warships, 120 aircraft, and up to 50,000 troops in the region. How long can the US keep this up?
Look, I think in terms of the offensive strike weapons, things like Tomahawk land attack cruise missiles, air-delivered weapons, they probably have a fairly decent supply. But the real challenge, I think, is in their defensive systems, things like the Patriot interceptor missile, THAADs. They are burning through stockpiles of those defensive systems at a fairly high rate, given the Iranian retaliation using their own Iranian missiles. So I do think there is a concern that the US may run low on defensive systems, and ultimately they will start to run low on offensive as well.
What about Iran's stockpiles? Iran has struck about 9 neighbouring US allies over the weekend. On Sunday, the UAE alone said it had so far dealt with 165 incoming Iranian ballistic missiles, 2 cruise missiles, and 541 Iranian drones. It just gives you an idea of the intensity that even just one US ally has faced from Iran. How long can Iran keep this up?
Well, it's a little more complicated with Iran because the Iranians are using ballistic missiles, as you indicated, as well as cruise missiles, but they're also using drones. And drones can be mass-produced in large numbers at very low cost. And so really, it's not a case so much of how many missiles and drones that the Iranians have. It's a case of how quickly can the US and the Israelis destroy those stockpiles and destroy Iran's ability to use those weapons. So it could be a race between the US ability to sustain offensive and defensive operations against Iran versus Iran's ability to continue to deliver weapons on target in forms of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones, and also survive US attacks on those systems themselves.
What of Russia's support for Iran?
Well, the interesting thing there is that supposedly Iran is a member of the Axis of Authoritarian States, which includes Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. And Iran, early on in this conflict, called Moscow and asked for help. And Moscow said, well, look, you know, we wish you all the best, but we're not going to give you any direct military support at this stage. And I think from Russia's perspective, they've got their hands full fighting in Ukraine. So it could be that Russians provide non-tangible military support in the forms of maybe intelligence support or maybe some sort of technical support. But I don't see the Russians, you know, intervening on the ground, and I don't see the Russians providing much in the way of military hardware. And I think the same can be said for the Chinese. So I think that the Iranians are very much on their own in this fight.
All this has a bearing on what you say is the war that really matters, a potential war over Taiwan. So what does the depletion of US stockpiles mean for that tension point?
Well, they're all concerned, because if the US starts to run low on defensive missile systems such as Patriot and THAAD, and then ultimately, as I said, the offensive systems such as Tomahawk land attack missiles and so forth starts to run out as well, then the US will have to bring in additional missiles. Chinese are watching. They're watching what is happening, what works, what doesn't work, how the Americans are fighting, and they're learning from this in anticipation of their eventual decision to capture Taiwan. It gives the Chinese a window of opportunity to be able to consider military operations against Taiwan. And certainly there has been concern in the past about China's intentions potentially within this decade. You know, 2027 has been a year that has often been mentioned in terms of China's intentions to invade Taiwan. So this war now that's occurring in the Middle East, if that continues for an extended period of time and you do see US starting to run low, that may incentivize Xi Jinping in Beijing to actually go for broke and start thinking about a war against Taiwan potentially next year.
Dr. Malcolm Davis is a senior analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
About 20 to 30% of global oil and gas supplies normally travel through the now closed Strait of Hormuz. Experts are warning that for every day trade is held up, the fallout grows exponentially. That, along with disruptions to global supply chains, could cause inflation to rise, something the business leaders and the RBA governor are concerned about. Here's David Sparks.
Western Victoria is a long way from the Middle East, but farmers like Brett Hosking are already preparing for the fallout from the war to arrive. The Victorian Farmers Federation chair says this is a bad time of year to have diesel prices go up.
Typically, throughout sort of that autumn break period, a grain farmer will be using multiple tens of thousands of litres of diesel, just putting the crop in the ground. We've seen a bit of rain across, you know, a lot of the country at the moment, so it'll be spraying costs. So herbicides will be put out to manage water conservation. So, again, that's a cost. So, 40 cent per litre multiplied by quite literally tens of thousands of litres, 50 to 100,000 litres in some cases, is enormous for growers.
Oil and gas prices have surged since the Israeli and US strikes on Iran began, principally because the conflict has all but stopped oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz. Analysts say it usually takes 7 to 10 days for oil price increases to flow through to Australian bowsers, and a worst-case scenario could see increases of 40 cents a litre.
The other real concern we have is around fuel availability. We know in Australia we have a little bit over 20 days supply of diesel in the country, but agricultural fuel supply could even be far less than 20 days.
Brett Hosking says the cost of fertiliser is also likely to rise. As for Australia's agricultural exports to the Middle East, those are generally transported by air. Chief Executive of the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, Andrew McKellar, says if airport closures in the Middle East continue, the impacts will grow.
Only 4 weeks ago, we had Gulf Food, the world's largest food and beverage exhibition in Dubai, and we were there for that. So one of the challenges for Australian exporters going into that market at the moment, some of the key products like beef are perishable. And with the airports and ports now under threat and closed in many cases for inbound traffic in those markets.
On the water, the cost of international shipping are already surging. Tom Jensen is General Manager of Freight Policy and Operations at the Freight and Trade Alliance.
We've seen the freight impacts in the Middle East for a couple of years now with the Red Sea crisis ongoing. But with the Strait of Hormuz closing, obviously that's meant shipping lines have now suspended services from that region and turned vessels around. The big kicker for that is that essentially they've also lumped on emergency conflict surcharges just in the last day. So basically that's around about $2,000 per 20-foot container or up to $4,000 per reefer container or refrigerated container. So what that does is effectively double the freight price overnight.
As all of this plays out, the Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, Michelle Bullock, is watching closely. Speaking at a business event this morning, she said the conflict could force inflation in either direction.
We're going to take some time to make sense of what it could mean for inflation here. A supply shock of this nature, for example, could add to inflation pressures. And the potential implications for inflation expectations also are something that we're very alert to. At the same time, a prolonged impact on energy markets could have adverse effects on global economic activity and result in downward pressure on inflation. And it's not obvious how this might play out.
Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock, ending that report by David Sparks. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on ABC Listen. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. The full deposition tapes of former United States President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton have been released. Over more than 9 hours of questioning from the House Oversight Committee, the political power couple were grilled on their connections to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. But there's no sign if it will affect the larger investigation into Epstein's crimes. Angus Randall reports.
Ahead of a marathon hearing, former US President Bill Clinton revealed why he chose to testify about his ties to Jeffrey Epstein.
I believe America was built on the idea that no one is above the law, especially presidents.
It marks the first time a former president has appeared before a congressional committee under subpoena. Records show Bill Clinton had a relationship with the convicted sex offender, starting from the early 1990s to the 2000s. He flew on Epstein's private jet, and Epstein visited the White House multiple times during Bill Clinton's presidency.
Through my brief acquaintance with Jeffrey Epstein, though it ended years before his crimes came to light, and though I never witnessed during our limited interactions any indication of what was going on.
In video released today of last week's deposition, the former president wanted to make one thing clear.
Since Hillary came in yesterday, she had nothing to do with Jeffrey Epstein. Nothing.
A position the former Secretary of State put to the committee herself.
As I stated in my sworn declaration on January 13th, I had no idea about their criminal activities. I do not recall ever encountering Mr. Epstein. I never flew on his plane or visited his island, homes, or offices. I have nothing to add to that.
In testimony widely reported, Mrs. Clinton can now be seen accusing the Republican-led inquiry of scoring political points rather than prosecuting those who were closest to Jeffrey Epstein.
This institutional failure is designed to protect one political party and one public official, rather than to seek truth and justice for the victims and survivors, as well as inform the public who want to get to the bottom of this matter.
Bruce Wolpe is a senior fellow at the United States Studies Center and a former Democratic staffer in Congress.
In legal terms, it is significant that a former president was subpoenaed and appeared before a congressional committee. That also may set other precedents for the current president and other future presidents.
He doubts there are any moments hidden inside the hours of questioning that will change the Epstein investigation or people's opinions of the Clintons.
I think there will be intense interest and gossip and consideration and op-ed articles, but I don't see anything significant here that will affect where American politics goes from here.
There are calls from Democrats for President Donald Trump to also testify, given his close ties to Epstein and the number of times he appears in the Epstein files. But given Republicans control the committee, this appears unlikely. Bruce Wolpe expects to see more hearings like this in future as one side seeks to embarrass the other.
I don't think American politics is getting healthier by these kinds of examinations, but because politicians believe you got to do this to win, and that's the objective, it's to win, not necessarily to do, but to win. And until we shake that, we are so far away from that, and the whole political culture is suffering because of it.
Bruce Wolpe is a senior fellow at the United States Studies Center. Angus Randall reporting. Well, here's some good news coming out of Australian workplaces with the latest data showing Australian companies are reducing the gender pay gap, even if it's small. But the agency monitoring the gender pay gap across the country says there's still plenty of work to do, with men nearly twice as likely as women to be in the highest paid roles and women still dominating the lowest paid work. National Work reporter Bronwyn Herbert.
Millie Paniamina works as a labourer on construction sites in Melbourne. She made a career change 2 years ago, leaving a management role in manufacturing.
It's intimidating, you know, but I choose to bring on my skills, my work efforts.
And the pay helps.
I'm earning a much better salary now than what I was used to earn back in the days.
Having more women working in higher-paying, male-dominated fields is helping to slowly close the gender pay gap. The latest data from the Workplace Gender Equality Agency compares the pay of almost 6 million workers from more than 10,000 employers across the public and private sectors.
So the good news is the gender pay gap is coming down.
Mary Woodridge is the chief executive of the Workplace Gender Equality Agency.
More employers have a lower gender pay gap than last year, and the measure we use is 11.2% gender pay gap, a midpoint of where 50% of employers have a gender pay gap higher than it or lower than it.
What this means is that for every $1 a man earns, women on average earn 88.8 cents. Companies with pay gaps of more than 70% include specialist medical services, Sydney Ultrasound for Women, and cardiologist at Vara Heartcare. Ray Cooper is the director of the Australian Centre for Gender Equality and Inclusion at Work at the University of Sydney.
We look at specialist medical areas. We know that men tend to dominate in the more highly paid, probably more technical, scientific end of the spectrum. Think about specialist surgeons, for example, as compared to the areas where women dominate in particular occupations, which might be frontline work in areas such as nursing and, you know, patient support.
A company spokesperson for Sydney Ultrasound said that the 79% gender pay gap reflects the structure of the workforce, with an extremely small number of men in senior roles significantly skews the overall percentage. Advara Heartcare acknowledged the high gender pay gap in the cardiology sector, but pointed to its company having a higher proportion of female cardiologists than the national average. While half of the employers analysed still have work to do to close the gender pay gap, the agency says more employers are now looking at what's needed to reach this goal. Luke Fowley is hoping to change the trend as a male registered nurse at one of Sydney's busiest hospitals.
Sometimes you do get a raised eyebrow from the odd patient and maybe a question of, oh, you know, why did you choose nursing, or why didn't you become a doctor? And if our workforce better represents the population we're serving, we're more likely to meet their health needs and close those gaps.
Luke Fowley is a registered nurse at one of Sydney's busiest hospitals. Bronwyn Herbert, the reporter. There are hopes a rare species of frog will bounce back from near extinction in northern New South Wales with the help of a breed and release program at Taronga Zoo. The endangered Bulong frog almost disappeared from the waterways near Tamworth during a drought, but conservationists say things are looking up for the species. James Paris reports.
Lachlan Thurtell is putting these Bulong frogs back where they belong.
Yeah, we're just going to go ahead, pop the lid off here and release these little guys.
The threatened species officer is part of a team working to revive the species that was once considered locally extinct.
And they're off. They're in their new little home.
Gemma Chowdhury has been raising the frogs at Taronga Zoo and says releasing 1,200 into the wild near Tamworth makes her want to jump for joy.
To be able to be here after 6 months of breeding this batch up, getting them fed and nice, fat, juicy frogs ready for release now, it's really special.
The Bulong frog has a mottled, warty-looking back and ranging colour from light grey or brown to mossy green, and don't grow bigger than 5 centimetres. 1,500 have been released in the region in the past 3 years, but this year is shaping up as the program's biggest yet. Gemma Chowdhury says it's all happening near Nundle, a small town south of Tamworth, where years of drought crippled their population.
Bulong frogs have been kind of found up near Tamworth, all around this kind of area, but with the droughts that happened from about 2017 to 2019, that really, really did decimate their population as a whole. So to be able to help out by breeding them back at Taronga, that means that we can release them at a stage when there is water around. So hopefully that means that they'll have a really, really good chance.
Local ecologist Philip Spark was the first to raise the alarm with Taronga Zoo when he realised the frog was on the brink of disappearing from the state's northwest.
All these streams were virtually bone dry, and the frogs went, in this catchment, they actually did go extinct. But, that drought was so severe because they'd been here for thousands of years and drought hadn't knocked them out.
Mr Spark has also been working with the Taronga Conservation Team and the state government to nurse the numbers back to health. He says they collected the few remaining animals from a nearby catchment to start the breeding program.
We managed to grab sufficient to get the captive breeding population happening. Lucky we did, because now we're able to put them back again.
Threatened Species Officer Lachlan Thurtell says the attention now turns to monitoring the steadily growing population and keeping them safe.
We go out at night. We've got head torches on, and you can spot them, their eye shine or their bodies, and we pick them up, we identify them, and we give them a quick health check, see what their weight's like, if their condition's good, and then we release them again.
Boosting hopes that with the right help, nature can bounce back.
James Paris reporting. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump says the war with Iran will continue until all his goals are achieved, and he's warned more US troops are likely to die. But if one of the aims is regime change, how can the US president achieve that without troops on the ground? Today, Hussein Abish from the Arab Gulf States Institute on why the war is unlikely to go as Trump planned. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.